This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, a busy show. Fred Parks, GOP State Senator, Fred Mills, rather, from Parks on drug pricing legislation and another special session. Also, Garland Goodwin Wilson, the artistic director of Moving Colors, reveres the Sofa Stories, which begins tonight at the Manship Theater. Michelle Ehrenberg, founder of Lift Louisiana on the status of abortion rights in Louisiana, as Governor John Bel Edwards signed a bill that would prohibit abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. And NBC Today host Al Roker is slated to start the show with us, recalling the historic Johnstown flood of 1889 and the message that it provides to contemporary America. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we begin with certainly a distinguished and well-known guest, Al Roker, the co-host of NBC's Today, 13 Emmy Awards in his career. He's been on Today for 22 years and the author of The Storm of the Century, an acclaimed history of the 1900 Galveston hurricane. Al Roker lives in Manhattan with his wife, ABC News, and 2020 correspondent Deborah Roberts, and his latest work is Ruthless Tide, The Heroes and Villains of the Johnstown Flood, America's Astonishing Gilded Age Disaster. And good morning, Al Roker, who's on his way to a family reunion, but it is a pleasure to share the microphone with you.
Well, good morning, Jim. Thanks so much for having me. Coming to you from JFK Airport.
Well, you're coming in loud and clear. And this Johnstown flood of 1889 is probably one that most people are unaware of. But May 31st of that year is a day that will live in infamy. It was quite an event, wasn't it?
It really was. And it changed a lot in this country. These rich fat cats who helped, you know, make America, you know, the industrial power that it is. Western Pennsylvania, we're talking names like Carnegie and Mellon and Frick. And this is about coal and steel and railroads. And they wanted to have a lovely, like, idyllic getaway. So they bought all this property around Western Pennsylvania and found this beautiful valley. And they ended up damming up a river. But they used a faulty dam and didn't rebuild it correctly. And the folks down in the valley, in the Conemaugh Valley, said, hey, this thing isn't safe, and if it gives way, we're going to have big problems. And they said, oh, we had our own engineers, everything's great. And sure enough, as you mentioned, May 31st, after a torrential rains, after a big snow melt, the dam gave way. 20 million tons of water emptied out of that lake and went down into the valley and killed 2,200 people. Still to this day, the greatest death toll due to a flooding event in American history.
Yeah, 20 million tons of water traveling at 40 miles an hour, swells as high as 60 feet. These people literally didn't know what hit them, did they?
No, they really didn't. There were some folks up at the club that they had who tried to warn people. One guy literally had to ride a horse through torrential rains to get to the closest telegraph office and telegraphed down to Johnstown, hey, this is coming. But, you know, the folks there, first of all, they didn't know who he was. And there had been some dam failures before or breaches, and nothing bad happened. And the area was used to flooding. They were used to moving their furniture up to the second floor and taking up their carpets. But the fact of the matter was, there was nothing like this had ever happened before. And it changed so many things in this country. It changed liability laws, because after the flooding and after the disaster, this club consisted of 60 members. It was a secret list. Well, only half of those folks donated to a relief fund and barely any money. And then when people tried to sue them, they couldn't collect. They couldn't get a judgment. And so it changed liability laws. It put the Red Cross on the map. Clara Barton's organization, up till now, had been dealing with, you know, Civil War survivors, things like that. Well, this was the first great natural disaster that befell this country in 1889, a natural disaster that was exacerbated by mankind. And they rose to the occasion, the Red Cross, and it became the preeminent rescue and recovery agency that it is today.
Clara Barton comes across as a hero in the book, as does a fellow named John Park. He was an engineer. How did those two converge in the Johnstown flood?
Well, you know, in doing this, you know, this guy, you know, he tried to warn people. He wanted to warn people. He wanted people to know what was going to happen. Clara Barton, when she showed up, the folks who were in charge thought she was looking for help, but she was, no, we're going to help you. We're going to make sure, you know, we organize and we get hospitals together and we get folks shelter and we get them clothing and we get them fed and we get them medical attention. It really was a Herculean effort. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was, look, you folks in Louisiana, you know what happens when engineering fails. Katrina, the majority of deaths didn't happen because of the hurricane. They happened because of a levee failure and a bad design and shoddy upkeep. You know, in this case, and what we're looking at now these days as environmental protections are being rolled back, as zoning regulations are being rolled back, as building codes are being rolled back, we are setting ourselves up for another disaster.
Yeah, what relevance does the Johnstown flood have today? I gather that you believe it has immense relevance.
Well, I really do. I mean, will we see 2,200 people killed at any one time in a flooding disaster? I can't say that. But what I can say is, as we see climate change taking hold, and whether you want to believe it or not, it's happening. And we are looking at greater storms, a greater frequency of storms, with higher rainfall amounts. If you look at what happened in Ellicott City, Maryland, 2 weekends ago, this is the second time in 2 years they've had a 1,000-year flood. We are setting ourselves up for this. And if we don't pay attention, we are going to see another, if not Johnstown, we're going to see more events like where we see massive flooding and loss of life and loss of property.
Well, at the height of the Gilded Age, tycoons had built a lakefront resort that lorded over the Allegheny Mountains. And can you imagine today if something like this happened with television cameras and the like and cell phones? This would be a story of epic proportions, wouldn't it?
It absolutely would. I mean, just think about Hurricane Katrina. If you know, that really happened before social media took off, as you alluded to, so rightly so. You know, it's going to be one of these things. I mean, you look at Ellicott City, Maryland, where we saw so many instances, people recording their being trapped, their homes being washed away, cars being washed away. We saw so much of that so quickly. It's going to be one of these things where I think this next disaster that happens is going to be probably one of the most recorded in history.
Al, you have been a staple in American homes for over two decades. I'm sure people are looking at you right now saying, there's Al Roker. Does it ever get old?
No, it doesn't. You know, because, I love what I do. I love the people who come to our window. I'm one of these people. I'm really blessed. A chunky, bald kid from Queens, New York, gets to do this, to go every day into 30 Rockefeller Plaza and you know, be on one of the iconic television shows in American history is pretty heady stuff, and it's not lost on me.
How is it being married to a great reporter and correspondent who is working for a competitor?
Well, you know, we first met at NBC. She worked at Dateline and NBC first and covered the first Gulf War and all sorts of huge news stories. And now, you know, we compete, but we don't. I mean, she's a hard news person. Although I will tell you, Jim, a few weeks ago, we were both in Windsor covering the royal wedding. And
yes,
our daughter, who's a freshman and just finished her freshman year at college, was her intern. And so she's got to see firsthand, really. I mean, our kids have always come into the office with us and stuff like that. But Leela got to go with Deborah and really be with her 24/7. And when we got home, she said, Dad, I learned two things. I said, what is that, sweetie? She said, one, Mom worked really, really hard. I said, yes, she does. And I said, what's the other thing? She goes, Mom works a lot harder than you. And I said, and that's the way Daddy likes it.
You described yourself as chunky. You're not chunky anymore. There's a new look, Al Roker, based on the work that you've done. And of course, as we know, television is certainly a cosmetic factor. You've got to look good.
Yeah, you know, look, I it's no secret. I went through I had a gastric bypass back in 2002, kind of a promise to my dad, who was dying of lung cancer. He said I had to lose weight. I was the one person, the one thing he was worried about. And so I did it. And, it's still a battle. Every day's a battle. But, I'm really lucky. I'm really blessed. And just happy to have my health. I mean, I've got my kids. I have a 31-year-old daughter. So sometime in the not-so-distant future, I'm hoping to have grandkids. So I want to be around for a while.
Do you miss Matt Lauer?
I do. I absolutely do. You don't work with somebody for over 20 years, and then they're gone and not miss them. And certainly if, you know, they were somebody who was a friend and somebody who was part of your family, it's still very hard. It's still very hard.
Do you talk?
We've had conversations, and I don't want to get into that any more than that. But I pray for him and his family. I pray for the families that were affected by this. And I just hope that folks can move on.
Well, thank you, Al Roker. The book is Ruthless Tide, The Heroes and Villains of the Johnstown Flood. It's a good read, and it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks, Al.
Jim, thank you.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and we're joined by Michelle Ehrenberg. She's joining us from the great city of New Orleans, co-founder and executive director of Lift Louisiana. Michelle's a Louisiana native. She worked for Planned Parenthood for many years. And tell us how Lift Louisiana started, Michelle.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. So in 2016, I co-founded Lift Louisiana with a local attorney who was representing some of the reproductive health clinics in the state. And mostly we started this organization because we really looked around and saw restrictions being passed, year after year, that were blocking access for women in the state to abortion care specifically, but really making it harder for women to access reproductive health care. And we recognized that there needed to be more advocates, both, talking to lawmakers about the impacts of these restrictions on women's health, and also legal advocates that could challenge these cases in the court of law.
How many clinics or how many places are available for women seeking abortions in Louisiana right now, Michelle?
Right now, there are three clinics that are serving a population of almost a million women of reproductive age in Louisiana, and that number is down significantly. In 2011, there were seven clinics, so more than half of the clinics have closed in the state in just the last few years.
And what's the reason?
Well, there's, I think it's hard to point to one specific reason, because there's a cumulative impact of the laws and restrictions that have been passed by both the legislature and then also, at the agency level. And a lot of these restrictions have really burdened the clinic's ability to stay open, in things like requiring, different kinds of certifications from the medical providers that are providing abortion services, making it more and more difficult for clinics to, have doctors that that meet a lot of these sort of unnecessary medical requirements, including, mm-hmm. Board certification and those kinds of things. And then, just the cost of complying with a lot of the regulations, the requirements to have additional staff, and you know, it's difficult to run a clinic when you're having to comply with so many regulations. You know, I like to think about it as, you know, if you had a law firm and you were practicing family law, let's say, and the state all of a sudden passed, you know, laws that said only family law clinics had to comply with regulations that required them to keep, let's say, 10,000 binder clips on hand, and a state regulator could come in at any minute and, you know, go into your inventory closet and count. And if you were one short of, you know, 10,000 binder clips, you know, you could be cited and have your license revoked for that kind of minor infraction. And that's exactly what's happening to the clinics that provide abortions in the state. So we saw in 2013 when the law requiring doctors to have admitting privileges at area hospitals, when that law went into effect, it actually had a huge impact. It closed, you know, two of the clinics because they didn't have doctors that could comply with that regulation.
Michelle Ehrenberg is our guest, the co-founder, executive director of LIFT Louisiana. 877-217-5757 if you'd like to join the conversation, and you can send us an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. You say there are three clinics still in business or running. Where are they located, Michelle?
There's one clinic in New Orleans, there's a clinic in Baton Rouge, and there's a clinic in Shreveport. So they are in the, you know, in the metropolitan areas, and that's a good thing. But if, you know, if you are a woman who is seeking an abortion in Lake Charles, you know, you're going to be making 130-mile one way, you know, then round trip to access one of these clinics. So the, you know, having that few clinics in the state mm-hmm. really is, you know, creating barriers to women that are trying to access abortion care.
Governor Edwards has signed a bill that would prohibit abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Your thoughts about this legislation?
Well, I mean, you know, we see this as another unconstitutional attempt to ban abortions before viability even. And courts have looked at this and consistently struck down similar bans. It really runs counter to longstanding Supreme Court precedent that was established under Roe v. Wade and then reaffirmed in 2016 in the Whole Women's Health decision. And, you know, many women seek abortion later in pregnancy because of, you know, the host of restrictive state laws or because there is a lack of abortion providers. And that may make it impossible for them to access abortion earlier in their pregnancies. And a lot of women may be delayed in their ability to access abortions because they need time to raise or save enough money to pay for an abortion. They're quite expensive. So we think that a ban on abortions after 15 weeks would leave many women without appropriate treatment options, you know, either when they, you know, need to seek care or when problems may emerge or worsen as their pregnancy progresses.
In your email, you quote Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Supreme Court Justice, fight for the things that you care about, but do it in a way that will lead others to join you. Now, Justice Ginsburg is one of those people who may not be on the court much longer. After all, we all at some point have a stopping point, but many are concerned in the abortion rights camp that one more vote that has been in favor of abortion rights going the other way would be the end of Roe v. Wade. How do you see it?
Well, I do think that, you know, the courts are changing, not just the Supreme Court, but, you know, we want people to be aware that there are, you know, very drastic changes happening at the federal judiciary at every step. So this administration is appointing young, very conservative judges to district courts, to, you know, circuit courts of appeal. And these people are going to be on the bench for a long time. And many of them are very opposed to abortion access.
All right. Melissa in Lafayette has been waiting patiently to talk with Michelle Ehrenberg. Melissa, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hi. This is more of a statement than an actual question. I had an abortion in 2015, and I'm a woman with a college degree, single, have a professional career, and it was a very hard decision. And I think a lot of people don't realize that I spoke with women as we were all waiting, and I had to go to Shreveport and go back and forth. I actually had to have a colleague take me because there was nobody available to drive and drive back, and that's how difficult it is. That these were women in college. Some were already mothers. Some had health issues. That this is not something that's an easy decision for women to make. And I know that the religious right has really taken this on as, you know, it's an act against evil, et cetera. But this needs to be approached as a humanity issue as well. Thank you.
Well, there's a waiting period, as we know. I suspect when you went to Shreveport, you had to wait there a while, didn't you, before you had your procedure?
Correct. You have to wait. You have to have the initial, which there is a mandatory ultrasound that you have to have done, and they ask you if you want a picture. And there was a very young girl there waiting in the lobby crying with her mother holding that picture. And there is, I believe, I think it was a 3-day waiting period, I remember. But yeah, and so you have to go and have that and then come back. And the surgical option was recommended for me, not the pill, because it would take more visits to have the pill done, and it just wasn't, it was a major inconvenience.
Well, Melissa, thank you for calling and sharing your story. Appreciate the call.
Of course. Thank you. Bye.
877-217-5757. We'll hear from Michelle Ehrenberg for a few more moments, the co-founder and executive director of Lift Louisiana. This is an organization that is promoting abortion rights in Louisiana, saying she started it to educate, advocate, and litigate to protect reproductive rights. We'll talk more with Michelle and also hear from Senator Fred Mills when we return after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Michelle Ehrenberg, founder of Lift Louisiana, an organization promoting abortion rights in Louisiana. And we're going to hear from Senator Fred Mills in just a moment. As you know, some major goings-on at the Capitol as well. Let's go to Nita in Zachary. Nita, good morning. You're on with Michelle Ehrenberg.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I wanted to make one comment and maybe a question. I guess some of the issue that I guess the folks on the pro-life side have is that it seems like some ladies are using abortion as a birth control method, where I'd rather give out birth control to those who need it. You know, what are her thoughts on that?
All right. Michelle, would you respond to Nita and Zachary about abortion as a birth control method? Some people view it that way. I'm sure you view it much differently.
Yeah, thanks, Anita, for that question. So I think that it, this raises a serious point in that there are not enough health clinics that are providing, you know, affordable access to birth control, and there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of women in the state of Louisiana that are in need of publicly funded family planning services, including contraception, and we really just are not prioritizing that. When we see those programs expanded in other states, they actually really do bring down the instances of abortion. So I think that should be a priority, especially of people on, you know, that are worried about the number of abortions that are provided in the state of Louisiana. But we're really not seeing that from our lawmakers.
Jennifer in Mid-City, yeah. We've got Jennifer who's been waiting patiently. You're on Talk Louisiana with Michelle Ehrenberg. Hi, Jennifer.
Good morning. My question is, the Advocate reported this week that Louisiana has spent more than $1 million defending unconstitutional court-challenged laws that restrict women's rights to abortion. So I wondered if Michelle could talk a little bit about how the pro-life lobby tends to prioritize lives that aren't actually, out and about walking on this planet.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer. Your response, Michelle.
Yeah, that is also a really great question. we had been looking into the amount of money that the state of Louisiana is spending defending these unconstitutional restrictions on abortion. There are currently five or six pending lawsuits against the state for, you know, regulations and restrictions going back 5 years or more in some cases. And, you know, at a time when, you know, you're about to have Senator Fred Mills on, who I'm sure is going to talk about this mess we're in with this fiscal crisis, and we're talking about closing down hospitals and cutting funding for TOPS and cutting funding for other services that families really need, it seems really irresponsible for the state to be committing millions of dollars, you know, defending these laws. And we've been making that point to the lawmakers over and over again.
Lastly, Marie in Baton Rouge sends this question. Has abortion demand decreased due to the improving economy and increased availability of contraceptives as a result of the Affordable Care Act?
Yes. The answer is yes. I don't know of an analysis showing that the improving economy has had an impact, but we do see a lot of research showing that the increased access to contraception provided by the Affordable Care Act, has been correlated with a decrease in the number of abortions all across the state, and that includes Louisiana. And so I think that that's a really important thing to look at, especially as, you know, we see conservatives trying to roll back some of the measures in the Affordable Care Act that actually increased access to birth control for women.
Right. Well,
I think that that's misguided.
Thank you so much, Michelle Ehrenberg, co-founder of Lift Louisiana, and we look forward to a return engagement soon. You can go to their website, liftlouisiana.org, if you would like to find out more about this group. Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
We're joined now by Senator Fred Mills, the pride of Parks, Louisiana, a pharmacist who is one of the more active members of the Louisiana legislature, and we're going to talk with him about a few matters, but Senator Mills, what's going on at the Capitol right now?
Wow, it's almost like a soap opera. It's the same drama over and over again, and it gets a little bit repetitive. We'll be going back in the special session. The governor tells me, I talked to him yesterday, we'll be going in the special session on the 18th, which is Monday, June 18th, and I think the main focus is going to be basically, can we generate some revenue that everybody can agree on to plug up the $648 million shortfall on the budget. It's almost a repeat since what's been going on since February.
It appears the hang-up is in the House. As a senator, are you mystified and perhaps a bit perplexed by what's going on in the lower chamber?
I'm not sure if mystified is the word. I think better time management, I think we could solve this. It just seems that at the end of every session, there's a scramble to pass some meaningful legislation, and the clock runs out. It seems that from what we did the last day of the session, it seems like the Senate had pretty much come to some good consensus between all sides, and it was pretty tough to see that when the clock struck 11:59 p.m. that the session had to end, and it seemed like a vote maybe could have solved the issue instead of coming back for a special session again.
When you look at your perspective as a pharmacist, there aren't many people like you. We have a lot of lawyers, a few doctors, some business people, but you truly are a, quote, man of the people. Do we need more people like Fred Mills from Parks in the Louisiana legislature?
You know, Jim, I always tease. I said, you know, I'm a pharmacist and I'm a bank president, so my main occupation is drugs and money. So I'm not sure if, you know, it always does help to have diversity in every way that you look at it, especially from a professional standpoint. I try and give as much expertise as I can on the healthcare arena. I'm chairman of the Senate Health and Welfare Committee, and we see a lot of diverse issues from water quality to everything under the sun. So I always preach that a lot of diversity helps.
You were involved in legislation this session related to drug pricing. How did that go?
It went really well. There were three or four bills that were passed, and it's an interesting topic. For years and years, I've been kind of studying that drug manufacturers give a pretty massive a rebate to the middleman, prescription benefit management companies. And it's always intrigued me that it seems like those rebates have not been shared with the consumer. And the rebates are very massive. So the legislation we've passed with a lot of cooperation from both the House and the Senate and the governor, basically it creates an opportunity for the consumer to save money on their prescriptions by those rebates being shared by the middleman to the consumer, and also having more transparency in reporting so that companies can see if those rebates are being shared properly between their employees and the middleman.
How exactly will the rebates work?
Well, the rebates work, there's three components involved in three bills that we passed. And the first component is that on a yearly basis, the health plans are required to certify that a majority of the rebates that they received are passed on to the patients at the point of sale. And that is very key, because this will be information that can be readily retrieved by the consumer and the employer, you know, and so that's big. And then there's another piece of legislation that all of the rebates, administrative costs, anything involved in that has to be on a website by the Department of Insurance, so you can analyze where those rebates are going and what administrative costs have been kind of sucked up by the middleman. And then there was a third piece of legislation that was passed by Senator Morrell that basically at the point of sale, if the consumer can receive the product at a cheaper price than their drug plan, now the pharmacist can basically say, hey, you have options. You can either use your drug plan and here's your copay of $40, or you can buy it directly without using the plan and I can sell it to you at $20. There was a gag order involved that prohibited that, and now we've lifted the gag order, and that kind of gives the patients more choices. And hopefully when we cobble those three pieces of legislation together, I really feel that the consumer can save money on the prescription end.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace, you're on the air with Senator Fred Mills. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Mr. Mills. First of all, I just want to thank you. I think you're one of the, you know, adults up there in the Capitol working for us, and I appreciate your spirit and your sense of humor. We're seeing the prices. I saw where there was a woman who posted this thing, how she had found out it would cost her $1,500 to get a procedure done at her dentist. And what she did is she flew to Mexico, and for that same $1,500, she got her procedure done. She got to stay in a great hotel and also buy some drugs at a reduced price.
All right. Are prices for health care, drugs in particular, are they out of whack in the United States as opposed to other parts of the world?
Yes. If you look at the prices in Canada, and the caller makes a great point, if you look at pricing in Canada and you look at pricing in Mexico, it is a vast difference. What has been discovered, though, especially in a lot of testimony, is, and I'll just make this up, drug A could have a sticker price of $400, but by the time you look at the rebates and the discounts that the middleman was able to get, that same drug could have a $150 net cost. And that's what this legislation does, is it analyzes what rebate that middleman is getting, and it basically, hopefully, when we get deep into the legislature and we implement it, those savings will be filtered down to the consumer. So the caller is 100% right, and these rebates are not known by the public that much. And I know I've been studying this issue, and rebates that are gathered by the
Okay, we do have to take a break. We'll spend a few more minutes with Senator Fred Mills and also hear from Garland Goodwin Wilson. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and in just a moment, we're going to hear from Garland Goodwin Wilson, who spent the last 20 years with Of Moving Colors, and there's a major production this weekend right here in our midst from Of Moving Colors. We're finishing up with Senator Fred Mills of Parks. And, Senator Mills, you note that special session, the seventh one in the last 2.5 years, will begin a week from Monday. If nothing happens and the fiscal cliff becomes a reality, what happens to the state?
Well, the way the budget is presently set up, with these cuts being on a pro rata share, I think the biggest concerns, will it be a lot of concerns, but higher education, TOPS for sure, will be a major problem. And then when pro rata share of the cuts come in, I mean, I've been hearing from district attorneys, they have major, major concerns, corrections issues. I think if that takes place, Jim, I think then the rhetoric becomes reality. And when the reality sets in and services aren't delivered and people aren't getting what they expect, I think there'll be a whole different discussion when implementation takes place.
And lastly, a caller mentions some of the stories done this week by the Advocate regarding lawmakers being involved in legislation which personally affects them. Is that appropriate?
You know, that's a great question. I know that I've handled much health care issues between nursing homes and hospitals and emergency care. It just seems that when you have the expertise in something, that that legislation migrates to you. What I've always asked the question is, can I handle legislation, say, for pharmacy, because I own a pharmacy? I've always been told that if it doesn't affect you personally and give you a competitive advantage, yes. And that's kind of what I've relied on. I've turned down certain legislation that I thought may be self-serving, but this year I think I handled over 20 pieces of legislation for different healthcare initiatives, and I guess if you look at it, sooner or later we all related somehow in this whole process, but to the consumer, I mean to the person looking for it, it could seem self-serving, but in my case I try and always refer to the Board of Ethics and make sure that I'm not violating any ethical laws on it.
Well, Senator Mills, thank you for joining us, and good luck in the 7th special session. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the work you do, and call me anytime, Jim.
Will do. Thank you, Fred Mills.
Take care.
We're joined in studio by the glamorous Garland Goodwin Wilson, who for 20 years has been involved with Of Moving Colors. She joined this great organization, OMC, in 1998 as artistic director, and she runs the show, and it is a great part of our community, a dance theater organization dedicated to creating and presenting excellent performances and community-based dance activities that inspire, educate, and stimulate. And tonight, the Sofa Stories. What's going to happen tonight and tomorrow night at the Manship Theater, Garland Goodwin Wilson?
Good morning. I think that tonight is going to be one of the times that the stage collides with two different perspectives. I don't think anybody will be able to imagine how we tackle so many things that people do on the sofa. How do you tackle binge watching in a dance concert? How do you tackle eating popcorn or breaking up with your boyfriend? How do you do that without dialogue? So I think it's really hard for people to imagine what it will be, but I think that once they're there, they'll have a blast. The show is really a lot of fun.
Only sofas could talk.
If only sofas could talk. That's what we've been saying. So much of life happens on the sofa, so come take a peek between the cushions.
But you're an organization that that promotes movement, and most people aren't moving on their sofa.
There is a lot of movement that happens in people's minds, and I think that we bring some of that out into the physical spectrum.
All right, and maybe there's more movement than I've
would seen you
understand.
Move, Jim, a time or two.
Not on the sofa, though. But Garland's a excellent teacher of dance, and I can attest that she taught me a few moves in a few minutes that I was even impressed at what she was able to do. So at my age, being able to move at all is an accomplishment. But this is a celebration of the human form and all its glory. And through the years, you have had some spectacular productions.
Thank you.
It's an entity, as I stated, that has a great relevance in our community. Tell us what exactly the mission is of Moving Colors.
Well, our mission's threefold, and I think each is so important. So part of our mission is to produce beautiful work. Well, you can't produce beautiful work unless you have beautiful dancers. So we are called to train the dancers and bring them up to a standard that we really believe is world class. And then, of course, with all that goodness, we have to give back. So we also believe in reaching out to the community. We just finished a really, really fun tour of 9 different adaptations of Edgar Allan Poe stories through middle schools around the city. And so we'd like to take what we do and bring it out to the community as well.
Well, the Sofa Stories tonight and tomorrow night, 7:30, Manship Theater. based on your previous works, I can't imagine just people sitting on a sofa. There's got to be more to this than that.
Absolutely. I think it's really just the springboard. You know, there are a few times when people do sleep. I'm a little worried they might fall asleep on stage. But no one will fall asleep in the audience. I can guarantee you that. So, you know, we've brought those actions to life. And when I said earlier that it's in your mind, our minds are so restless with so many things. And so we try to take that energy, whether it's a sad energy or happy energy. Mm-hmm. And then we also have the practical. I mean, there's a whole dance that's just about folding clothes because every mother
so there is dancing. There is dancing in the
dancing.
Sofa. Lots of
yes,
dancing.
Start to finish. Dancing, dancing, dancing. And then, like I said, we did throw in a little laundry. Every mother that has sat on a sofa and folded some clothes needs to get a kudos for that.
What's one of the subjects?
Laundry. We even have some video gaming. So we've brought Mario to life, and she's very cute. So I think in the mushroom people, whoever they are, I'm not a Mario person, but I love my mushroom people. And we do have binge watching. So we have a few times where this woman is encapsulated by she's becoming glued to her couch, and through movement that happens. And then there are bigger things. Mm-hmm. There's receiving bad news. There's falling in love. Christian Von Howard out of New York City came into Baton Rouge a while, and he created this incredible duet that is about falling in love. And, of course, many of us have had some romance on our sofa. And he really uses the couch. We have one couch that's on wheels, and it's spiraling all around stage. And he uses that as that whirlwind energy when you do fall in love with someone. So there's some beauty. We have playing with the cushions, forts, and building forts, and just good old-fashioned play that probably every adult should try again. I think we all should go home today and jump on our couches and see how we feel about that.
Who are some of the stars of the show?
Well, the biggest star is actually, I'm not the leader of the pack this time. Courtney Landry, our associate artistic director, has curated and choreographed most of this work. And she has done an amazing job. So she's been the associate artistic director for a couple of years, very, very amazing dancer as well for about a decade. And she's really brought it to life. And we've brought back in Marlon Grigsby. He's in Texas now. He's done some with the Nutcracker. And we have our own fabulous male dancer, Julian Guillory. And they're Carrie Tatum, my partner in crime. She is hilarious. People should come just to see how she walks across the stage in high heels and sits on the sofa, because she just brings humor to life. She's so funny. Funny, funny, funny.
And dancers, as I've stated a few times, are some of the best athletes in the world.
It's a very physical show, Jim. It's a challenge for the dancers. They don't. It's funny that you ask if there's dancing. Yes, there's dancing, and they hardly are able to take a breath.
Well, there has to be dancing if it involves of moving colors.
That's right.
And some of these people are on stage for a little while, so they're moving.
Yeah, there's a piece that's really about a couple that's been married for a long time, trying to decide if they're going to go their own way or not. And I think it's a 7-minute piece that's pure physical partnering and jumping on each other, throwing each other, feeling each other, helping each other, you know, holding each other up. So if you want to I think everyone will be able to relate to it. So I hope you'll get off your sofas and come see ours.
Sofa Stories, no question, the most exciting theater I've seen in years. That's one of the reviews for Of Moving Colors, the Sofa Stories, tonight, tomorrow night, 7:30. Manship Theater at Shaw Center for the Arts. And if you'd like more information, you go to manshiptheater.org or call 344-0334. That's 225-344-0334. Elise asks, as we part, Garland, are you game to answer whether you think the Miss America pageant should get rid of the swimsuit competition?
Well, my sister was in the Miss LSU pageant, and she hated it, but only because she didn't like her body. I think those women that love their bodies don't mind there being a swimsuit competition at all. So I think it's really up to the women and the people that run that. I mean, even with dancers, there are dancers that love to get glamored up, and there are dancers that don't. So I think that's really a question for those that are involved.
Well, your shows are always in spectacular taste, but there will be some beautiful people on stage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Always beautiful people. And dancing helps the process. You know, Al Roker can get his gastric bypass surgery, but you don't need that, do you?
No, sir.
Because you're moving. of Moving Colors is the entity. It's been around since 1987, so it has stood the test of time, and times are always challenging for artistic organizations, nonprofits, but you've managed to make it go.
Well, you know, he was talking about what money would be cut from the state, so the arts always come on the chopping block, so you're right.
Well, this is an important event for Moving Colors, the Sofa Stories, tonight, tomorrow night, 7:30, Manship Theater, again, 344-0334. Thanks for listening. Back Monday. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.